The session is entitled Partnering with Informal and Non-Formal Bible Education. And there's so many definitions floating around for the two terms, informal and non-formal, and even formal. So I've invented three that I use, and this is them. Formal, students study at accredited tertiary institutions. And most of you are representing those kinds of institutions. Non-formal, students study at institutions, Bible colleges, church-based programs which do not offer accredited formal programs. So they may have some kind of qualification or certificate or something like that, but it's not accredited. And finally, informal, that's training that takes place by observing, practicing, internships, etc., without actually studying programs. So you come to my church, you come and learn from me, you watch me, I give you opportunities. That's informal. It's learning by experience. So I hope that serves as the definition basis for what we're going to do. Well, here are some stats that will help us in our discussions, and this is a workshop. It's not a talk, but I do feel we need to just clarify a few things to start with. So in 2016, when I still served as the president of SATS, I attended a conference in Thailand, and on the first night, this research by Todd Johnston was released, which said that 95% of all pastors in the world do not have a formal qualification. That amounted to a huge number, about 2.2 million at that stage. But since then, the Global Alliance for Church Multiplication, some of you know it as GACX, around that time, they determined that they were going to plant 5 million multiplying churches. 5 million multiplying churches. And by September last year, they had planted about 2.2 million of those. And of course, each of those needs a pastor. Then Dr. Thomas Schirmacher, who is the General Secretary of the World Evangelical Alliance, he says that there are 50,000 new baptized believers every day. And if you take an average of 50 to start a new church, that would mean that you need 1,000 new pastors a day. So that research that was announced in 2016, by my estimate, has now gone up to something like 4 million. So there are 4 million pastors in the non-formal sector. Some of them have been trained at institutions and have received some form of non-formal qualification. Others have not been trained or they've been badly trained. Some of them just pronounce themselves to be pastors without any form of training whatsoever. So we need a lot of new pastors. And how's that going to happen? Well, if you add up all the students in all the accredited programs in the world, we're talking universities, seminaries, Bible colleges that have accredited theology training programs, they make up about 5% of the need. So we have to draw the conclusion that formal, good as it is, and we need them, we need you guys very badly because you provide the thinkers, but non-formal is the place where most of the training needs to be done if we have any hope of solving what I believe is the greatest crisis in the church today, and that is untrained pastors. Because on a Sunday morning, when those people step into the pulpit, what they often preach is diabolical, and you know what it's like because you come from those circles. So we're going to go into the workshop side of it just for a few minutes, and I'm going to pose a few questions to you. So you've got yourself nicely positioned. You've got three over there, three over here, three over here, two over there, and three over there, plus those at the back can just form themselves into a group. And I want you to spend 10 minutes discussing a solution to the crisis. So I've posed the crisis to you. It is that we have 4 million pastors in the non-formal sector and 1,000 new pastors every single day. I would like you in your discussion groups just for 10 minutes to discuss a solution to that crisis. Let's have a couple of groups just to feedback quickly. And I see Arthur Allard has volunteered to be the first reporter. So, Arthur, what did your group come up with?
So, we're just discussing the importance of these three different outcomes: formal, credit training, informal, where it's not accredited or recognized anywhere else, and then non-formal, and just the huge task in the non-formal sector as well, because the non-formal training that is taking place is training has taken place in a structured church environment where pastors are being trained, their training are being recognized, and just think in terms of the amount of pastors that need to be trained. What did you say, 4 million?
My estimate is about 4 million at the moment.
It's about 4 million and about 1,000 pastors
a day
that need to be trained. And we already know that all of institutions, all of us, public, private, are only getting 5%. And if you do the calculations from 2016 to now, what did you say? Probably 2.5%. So there's a huge gap that that is needing people that are needing equipping. And the non-formal is providing what currently the formal institutions can provide in a short space of time. I can't remember if you gave us any numbers of how your ministry functions as well.
I'll come to that a bit later.
But we see a need for the formal institutions to find ways to up the percentage of what they're doing as well. But also we see this great need for non-formal training taking place as well.
So in true academic terms, this group restated the problem. But the question was, discuss a solution to the crisis.
You're going to see how we can support those that are doing non-formal.
Joseph, your group, how did you do?
We were talking about the relationships being key to doing training.
Relationships between formal and non-formal?
Individuals, between individuals. So that, because one of the issues is that there are a lot of people that are serving as pastors that are leading people astray, and they're causing people to be disillusioned by the church. And we were speaking that sometimes God permits these things to happen and get people to where they are at their lowest point, where the true church, where Christians can come and actually build relationships and be a witness and draw them to where they need to be to receive training.
Okay. Joseph? Joseph's representative?
Yes, we talked about that you obviously need trainers that train trainers to do that. And then we realized that there were lots of problems and hurdles that must be overtaken with quality and things. And that led us to materials. That what we really need are really good materials to put in the hands of people as tools for training, whether it's in non-formal or informal situations. And so once we started talking about tools, we immediately went to books and things, but then we started talking about newer tools like videos that people can watch, or WhatsApp groups that can be used, or ways that you can record a lecture on WhatsApp and then have a PDF that they can follow along the slides while listening. Or even things like recording Zoom sessions that can be shared via WhatsApp, or things like that. And then our time was up.
Thank you for that. Some positive suggestions there. I'm going to come to the second question in just a minute, but we'll take one more. Just a thought for that group to consider is that 2 billion people in the world fall into the orality movement. And so any solution that you come up with should take into consideration the 2 billion. Yes, sir.
Thank you very much. very much. My name is Comfort. We said one, let's partner with the churches where this is actually taking place. That is us institutions. Pastor, partner with the churches where this is actually taking place. It may also mean, to some extent, going out and collecting data in terms of where are we. I'm from Eswatini, for example, and it's a small country with about 1.2 million people. To conduct research and pick up and find out exactly where the needs are, it will take that much time. Number two, offer both accredited and non-accredited training, both of them. Let's recognize them. Number three, we talked about online training. We said, okay, online training in these days could reach a few people, quite a few people, but who is actually online? A lot of people in this part of the world in Africa have cell phones, but not necessarily computers. Mm-hmm. Now, you will need to have a computer. Huh? You need to have a computer to be online and for this to make sense. Not just a cell phone, but that's good for thought. Number three, number four, let's train the other people. Let us be focused by way of addressing the needs of certain persons who may not necessarily want to be pastors. And these are the very people that can turn around and help the pastor. But here I just talked about the pastors. But pastors need assistance with the children's ministry, with the youth, etc. So the training of the need, as far as you said, producing 1,000, we need 1,000 pastors
a day.
Yeah, that's. But we need 1,000 pastors with maybe two or three of them being assisted by someone else. We need to keep training to those persons. And
who's the we?
Eh?
Who is the we?
Institutions.
So the institutions, you're saying, should introduce programs to train pastoral helpers?
Yes. Collaborating, partnering with the churches. That's very, very key. Because we are serving the churches.
Okay.
Yes. And then finally, what did I say? Oh, the same one, like mobilize church leaders as well. That's mobilizing church leaders also, they need training. For an example, where I come from, we train the pastors, we require that the pastors must have a minimum of a 3-year training. But nothing for the elders. But the elders sometimes, they stand in the pulpit, they preach, but no requirement for the elders to be trained.
Right. Thank you. Thank you for that. Hold your thoughts on this as we go into the next question. But just let me tell you that no one has ever conducted research to find out how many of these training programs there are in the world. Our estimate is that there are between 40,000 and 100,000, probably closer to 100,000. And we have a survey out there at the moment to try and get that information. But it is extremely difficult. I would say it's impossible. So each of those 100,000 training programs does something. Some of them ordain their pastors after 3 weeks. Some of them take 3 years. And they're all doing their own thing. There are no standards, well, there hasn't been up to now anyway, standards that everybody agrees on. Which is amazing, because if you want to be a nurse, you've got to meet a certain standard and you've got to be registered with somebody and you've got to do continuing professional development points every year. Same for engineering or other professions, but not for pastors. They can just find a little hall on the corner, hire themselves as pastors, declare themselves to be super apostles, lead bishops, super elders, chief apostle. I've got an article on the internet about that, you can read it. All these titles that they self-proclaim, and no one ever asks them, so where did you train? Who registered you? No, he's just the apostle. And they accept it, and off he goes with his malpractices. So these are some of the thoughts, just to stir you, because the next question says, what pitfalls could there be in your solution, in that solution that you found to question one. What could the pitfalls be? Okay? Okay, let's hear from the three groups that we didn't hear from in the first round. We'll start with the group at the top there. Would you like to just share with us? There is a mic which Arthur has in front of him. I'm sure he'll pass it on to you.
Yeah, what we just discussed in terms of the pitfalls, one of the major areas that we identify is that those who go through the informal kind of training, they happen to find themselves maybe not recognized by the very same local pastors or trainer, of which that's really an issue that cannot just be looked down upon. But it is really significant. The other aspect concerns the time factor. If we are to engage them in training them, is 3 months really enough, or do they really as well to have an extended kind of a period of training? Because for some, definitely they might use a limited time of training those men, and you wonder if they are really trained for the task. We also pointed out that this informal, in most instances, you may find it's not structured like the formal. And that could also be an area which falls under the pitfalls.
Are you saying that the formal has the right structure?
Not necessarily that they have the right structure, but at least they do have the structure wherein you know these are the items that they're going to go through, or these are the projects they're going to go through, these are the modules they're going to go through, and now they're finished. But if you're just going on and you watch, you observe, you perform, at what point do you say, now, we have really trained that?
I'm just throwing that in there because there may be some institutions who have the wrong structure.
Oh, yes, that's definitely true. All right, well, the other aspect that we just touched is in terms of conversion and the calling, as well as the involvement in the church. You really would love to confirm, maybe, or affirm the conversion and the calling, and is the person really involved in the congregation. If they are not really involved, you really don't just want to continue training those kind of people.
So a good question to consider at some point, and it's not going to be here, is whether people who are trained in formal institutions are competent pastors. So my contention would be that many programs in formal institutions produce people who have covered what is necessary for a pastor, but they don't produce good pastors, because they've never asked them to demonstrate what they've learned. It's about head knowledge more than about practical application. I'll just throw that in as something to think about. So what about this group over here? Your pitfalls. We only have about 5 minutes, so.
I think when we talked about many things, I think we identified more with the problem than anything else. But I think just one of the pitfalls is to always stick to the same formula or the very same structure. We just, you know, distinguish waiters, say people do say three days of training in a week and then go back to the congregations. Where the more formal structure must say complete 3 years, then you go to the congregation. So that could be one of the pitfalls, is that we stick to what we always used to do,
right,
and don't invent new structures and programs.
Very good point. This group on my right.
So we came up with a couple of pitfalls. Number one was measuring outcomes. If you think about non-formal, so we didn't focus so much on informal, we focused more on non-formal.
Right.
If you think about non-formal theological education, if there's 100,000 of them, if the final goal of that is skills outcomes, we speculated that there's very little assessment of the actual skills outcomes taking place. And the problem is, where you see, you kind of invited just a second ago, but where you see the only place you can assess skills outcomes is in the life of the congregation. So the feedback that you need is actually the end user, the congregant. That's the feedback you need if you're going to actually measure your skills outcomes for pastors coming through non-formal theological education. And we don't have any data, but some of us are involved in it, and we realize most non-formal theological education measures itself in terms of numbers of persons through the program. That's the measurement. And we both did it, like 2,600, like we measured ourselves in terms of people who come through the program,
right,
which isn't actually a measurement of outcomes, it's only a measurement of heads. And so that's a significant drawback, regardless of your design. Unless you're measuring skills and you're getting feedback from the end user, your assessment is at best piecemeal. So that was one of our drawbacks. And another one is competition. So either competition between churches and so like more established churches with you know bigger leadership, seeing grassroots things come up and perceiving them as a threat, or even competing grassroots organizations stepping over each other. You know, we each travel 500 kilometers into each other's territory to, you know, and we're, because some small rural church somewhere asked us to come, and but there was another institution 20 kilometers away that could have offered it, and we end up expending huge amounts of resources. We talked about a lot of that, where, you know, you might need to do translation work, but first you pour all your resources into producing your own grassroots material, and there you spend all your resources on that, and now you don't have any resources left to translate to get it into the language the end user needs it to be in. So we end up reinventing the wheel over and over and over and over again because we are territorial, either in terms of program design or material or content or things like that. And those, there's a lot of resource wastage and unnecessary competition.
You're absolutely correct. One of the saddest things for me is that for so long, and hopefully it's coming to an end, for so long, this competitive spirit between institutions, between formal and non-formal, has been so strong that we don't get to the point where we actually reach the goal of training pastors. And if we are going to train 1,000 new pastors a day, the competition has to stop. We have to stop. We have to stop worrying about that person's student becoming my student and he's stealing our congregation and all that nonsense. Because we have 4 million pastors, people, who need training. And unless all the institutions who do training, all of them, get to the point where they say, let's set aside our differences. Let's focus on the goal. And the goal is to train pastors. And unless we do that, this is a lost battle. We're going back into our territorial camps, the silos that were spoken about this morning. We have to get beyond that. Okay, next question. Where should the formal theological education be positioned in your solution? So most of you sitting here come from the formal sector. Where should formal theological education be positioned in your solution? Who would like to start for us? I see your hand, sir. Thank you. That group over there?
Yeah. Basically, you're saying that formal needs to probably be primary, and then you allow the formal to filter down to your non-formal and informal. Because your formal provides a structure, it provides a quality teachers, it provides a quality curriculum. And like I was saying, the students that are, potential students that are often come to me for our business program, the two questions that are asked all the time. First one is, how much does it cost? And the second one is, are you accredited? And irrespective of their motive, why they want an accredited piece of paper, that is one of the primary driving forces. And so I think if we need to have the formal as being primary, but we mustn't be selfish and not let it filter down to everything else. And I think that's been one of the downfalls of institutions. They've had the formal as primary, but they now become this ivory tower, and those at the bottom that can't get into the ivory tower suffer. So we need to let that be primary, but we mustn't not let it filter down to everything else.
Thank you. Another?
That man.
You're learning.
Okay. I'm glad that Lynn had something to say with this, because we, as we were describing the ideal way of doing it, we were actually thinking that there's already a lot of this going on, where there's a marriage between a formal parachurch organizations and the structured institutions and working in partnership with local churches. So there's already that thing going on, and we're just using the distance model as an example. In that way, it uses some of the pitfalls, because in our group we're saying that one of the pitfalls is resistance, also locally, and not just in the form of people wanting accredited qualification, but this thing of being being skeptical of that they need training at all. But if it's something that happens locally, and there's a relationship between local churches and people working together, then it's easier to break down that resistance also.
Okay, let's leave it there. Take one more group. There we go, right in the corner.
I don't like to disagree with Glenn, but I might do it anyways. So our group was wrestling with whether or not formal should be viewed as primary. And Jack and I had a good back and forth. We like to take either side of the equation and kind of find consensus. But we did, I think, maybe Jack would disagree, but I think what we ended up saying was that formal theological education has never been and should not be the primary producer of pastors. I mean, it's 1,500 years that the church happily produced pastors outside of the structures of formal theological education. The New Testament produced pastors outside of the structures of formal theological education. Pastors are produced in the context of local churches through trained men training men. And by that, I don't mean formally trained men. I mean a church trains a man who then trains a man who trains a man who trains a man who trains a man. So what we think, I think what we ended up saying is that formal theological education is here, obviously, and we are all engaged in it, but it should be a servant. It should be the tip of the spear should be formal in non-formal theological education. That's where pastors need to be produced, is through non-formal theological, whether they have access to formal theological education or not. A church needs to have the skills, and leaders in that church need to have the skills to mentor and train, whether through a program or network or whatever. Non-formal needs to be the primary engine of producing pastoral leadership. And then to answer the question, where does formal theological education exist? The only purpose of formal theological education, though, produces people who are capable of training others. So it merely feeds the engine of the training, but it's not the primary producer of pastors.
Thank you.
That may be a little unpopular.
Well, it's a controversial statement, and it's a good one because it makes us think very deeply about this issue. Thank you for these answers. I want to respect your time. We've got 10 minutes left. I would have asked you question 4, which comes to the hub of something you said earlier. What should we do about quality assurance in non-formal ministry training? We don't have time to do that, but it's something that's really a hot potato right now. So let me share with you in the closing 10 minutes a possible way ahead. First of all, you may be familiar with ICET. It's the International Council for Evangelical Theological Education. And if you are accredited, for example, by ACTI, then you are directly related to ICET, because ICET is the body that controls the 8 regions of accreditation in formal theological education around the world. And every 3 years, they have a conference for formal theological educators. There's normally about 450 to 500 delegates, and they do an excellent job. But last year in October, they realized The real issue is the issue that we are talking about here. And so they decided to spend a year preparing for their next conference, which is going to be in Turkey in November. It would be wonderful if you could be there, because this issue is the issue. And I'm on the organizing committee for that conference, and we, in preparation, have had consultation-type Zoom sessions with more than 100 delegates from different sectors around the world, trying to bring formal and non-formal together for the first time, to try to do something about bridging the gap between these two issues. And slowly but surely, it is working. The barriers are beginning to fall. ICET has something called the ICET Academy. You can see it online. And they run a forum on this topic, especially the hot potatoes like quality assurance in non-formal. Now, initially, those in the formal sector were a little bit perhaps guarded in their responses, but as the consultations have increased, more and more people have begun to realize that this is something that we have to do. And so you can go to those forums now and you'll see hundreds of responses from many sectors around the world. Now, it's a formal structure, I said. So what they are doing is creating, as they would say, we are laying a table for non-formal to have a voice. And they are so intent on this that they are busy raising sponsorships so that those from the non-formal sector, the representatives, maybe the larger players, if you like, will only have to pay half of the fare to attend the conference. It's a four-day conference. It will be a working consultation rather than a talking heads kind of conference. So the sessions are going to be structured around what we are doing right now, finding a solution. And I would really encourage your institution, doesn't matter whether you've attended in the past, ask your principal, if he's not here, ask the leaders if at least one person from your institution can attend that conference. And let's see if we can, by the end of this year, chart a way forward. One of the ways that's beginning to emerge, and I'll share it with you, is that the non-formal sector should themselves form a body like ICET. Not controlled by ICET, not controlled by the formal sector, but where the voice of the non-formal determines the way forward for non-formal. And that is beginning to gain traction. So that's one of the ways forward. Another way forward is Reforma, and you know that that's the project I direct. I'll just share quickly, because I'm not here to sell Reforma. I'm just giving this as one of several options. After that meeting in 2016 that I mentioned, a group of people got together from different parts of the world, and they said, let's find a solution for these non-formal people. And so after a series of meetings, this question was posed to us. What does a pastor need to be able to know, to do, and to be in order to be declared competent? What does a pastor need to be able to know, to do, and to be? And that, well, that's character, the B part. So that group came up with 35 competencies. And each one of those competencies, we attached an outcome. So those 35 outcomes were underwritten by the World Evangelical Alliance. So when the certificate gets issued, it has the Reformer logo on, and it has the World Evangelical Alliance, and it's signed by both leaders. It is something that, for the first time in church history, has created a standard for non-formal ministry training. Now, initially, the first task was to tell the world that's available. And so 2.5 years ago, we began enrolling groups of students to do not our curriculum, because Reformer is not a curriculum provider. You guys are the curriculum providers, and the non-formal sector provides lots of different options. But to provide a standard, it's like going for your driver's license. When you get there, the examiner is not interested in, did you learn from a driving school? Did your uncle teach you? Did your mother teach you? All he's interested in, he's got a set of criteria there in front of him, and if you can drive the car according to that criteria, you get the license. And it's exactly the same with this standard. So what we initially thought was that a lot of groups with curricula would enroll, and they did. But we also found, much to our surprise, that there are thousands, and I'm talking tens of thousands, of these groups that have no curricula at all. They have no standard, they have no information, they have no links to anybody. They're out there in the rural areas of India or Nepal or somewhere, and they are running a church, and some of them are doing a brilliant job, but they don't have any formal way of studying. Formal, non-formal, informal, they have nothing. So we wrote comprehensive notes for each of those 35 outcomes, and we send that to them when they enroll, not as a compulsory way of teaching the outcomes, but simply to provide some resource that the facilitator can use in order to prepare the lessons. And we go out and we train them in their communities. We send 5-minute recordings every week to them in 4 different languages in order to help them prepare their lessons. We started enrolling groups September 2.5 years ago. This program is free, by the way. They only pay $5 for the certificate at the end. But the program is free. There are, as I speak, 1,384 groups enrolled already in 81 countries in 22 languages. Because people have begun to realize we need a common standard. We need something that everybody can say, okay, if he's got that certificate, which is underwritten by the World Evangelical Alliance, we know that that person is competent to be a minister. So that's Reformer. And then the last one I want to talk about in the last 2 minutes is the Galilean movement. Now, I'm pretty sure you've not heard of the Galilean movement. I'm pretty sure you've heard of the Lausanne movement. In 1974, Billy Graham and John Stott brought all the evangelical leaders in the world together in Lausanne, and the result of that was that the church was committed to do evangelism, and that's what the Lausanne movement is all about, and some of you may have been privileged to be at the 2010 one, which was in Cape Town. But another movement is beginning to emerge, not to compete with Lausanne, because we'll never want to stop evangelism. But another movement has had its preliminary meetings, started with 5 people who were key leaders from around the world in the evangelical world. It's now 15. By the end of the year, it will be 100. These people are committed to training, wait for it, 1 million pastors a year. That is their opening statement. They are committed to train 1 million pastors a year. So in their preliminary meetings, they've considered structures, how to do it, what the mission and vision and all those things are. And I was invited to attend as an observer. So I happened to be in the same place as they were meeting. So I've attended a couple of their meetings. And these are senior leaders. So the current leader is the previous General Secretary of the World Evangelical Alliance, Bishop Ephraim Tendera from the Philippines. And he's got around him a team of people who can raise the money, who can do this thing. So the aim is that I think by 2024, there will be a global conference in Galilee. That's why it's called the Galilean Movement. And it will set the stage for the church not to abandon evangelism, but to commit itself to training pastors. Because that's the big need right now. Everybody has to grasp this. The biggest need in the church right now is to train competent people for ministry. If we don't do that, this crisis is just going to get worse. So that's the Galilean movement. And I trust that this little session, it's been a short session, sure, but hopefully it's given you some food for thought to go away and think about some of these key issues.